Ea ka aha, ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano, ua a koa koa maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 18773, in the interest of LI and HDK. Arguing for the petitioner, Michael A. Glenn. Arguing for amici curiae, Thomas A. Helper. Arguing for the respondent, Adriel C.S. Minor. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, aloha everyone. This proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. I'd like to thank Judge Cataldo for sitting with the court today. Thank you, Judge Cataldo, for being here. During the proceeding, should a justice have a question, they'll raise their hand and I'll call on them at the earliest opportunity. And I'll ask our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they'll be arguing.
Thank you. Mike Glenn, arguing for petitioning mother.
Tom Helper, arguing on behalf of Amici.
Very well.
Adriel Minor, Deputy Attorney General, arguing on behalf of the Department of Human Services.
All right. Just to confirm, Mr. Glenn and Mr. Helper, you'll each have 10 minutes for your opening argument and each have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Minor, you'll have 30 minutes for your argument and you'll see a light and a tone, hear a tone at the end of your allotted time. Mr. Glenn, please proceed.
Well, Your Honor, actually, we wanted 11 and 4 for the direct and the rebuttal, if that's possible.
That's fine with that. That's absolutely fine. We'll try to track it as best we can. And if you would, then please proceed. And again, Mr. Minor, we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. So with that, Mr. Glenn.
Thank you. Good day, Chief Justice, Associate Justices, and Judge Cataldo. On January 6, 2014, this court set forth a clear edict. Hawaii mandated the appointment of counsel for parents whenever the state assumed foster custody of their children. My client had every right to rely that the judge presiding over her FCS case, the deputy attorney representing Hawaii's Department of Human Services, and even the minor's GAL would be well aware of such a Supreme Court decision. The family court judge that heard mother's case in Maui over 12 full months after this command to appoint counsel was issued on January 15th, 2015, nevertheless clearly ordered foster custody, preventing mother's right to parent, and did so without appointing any attorney for mother. Mother pleaded, "I would like her in the home also. That's what I've worked for all this time. I don't understand. I'm just going to stand and wait for my kids because all this makes me so confused. Being in the courtroom, the smell and everything just..." Eventually, the judge told mother, "Just let them know your address and phone numbers and keep in contact with them. Then no problem, okay? But as far as the court's concerned, I'm going to continue foster custody unless there's something different." Mother again pleaded. "I don't think, after the court said we're going to take away your children and you can come back 3 months later," mother pleaded, "I don't think it should take 3 months for that. I don't see why the whole situation needs to change to foster custody. That's a big deal for me, you know? I don't see why a home check should take switching her case to something like foster custody." And mother told the judge, "That's ridiculous." Now, to make things even more egregious in this case, at that hearing, the Maui judge was verbally notified that if foster custody was in place, mother needed an attorney appointed. The record indicates an unidentified speaker, perhaps the child's GAL, saying, "So she needs an attorney." And the state DHS worker said, "Yeah, she needs an attorney." Rather than respect mother's guaranteed right to counsel here, after being directly reminded of it, the family court judge rather stated, as the ICA noted this was inadequate, "Maybe we can deal with it when we come back on April 14th. Right now, just based upon her responses in court, I hope she does get the psych eval and gets therapy." He made the ruling that he was revoking family supervision and granting custody for the period of November 7th, 2014 through December 15th, 2014, retroactively. That's even more egregious than failing to provide. He did it without even having a hearing retroactively.
Mr. Glenn, we have a question from Justice Wilson.
Yes, certainly.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Glenn, I'm interested in your interpretation of the record as to when you think the attorney should have been appointed in this case for LI's mother. And I understand you're focusing on the January 13th hearing, so perhaps the January 15th hearing, 2015. Thank you. But assuming that that's the date and that you were concerned that counsel wasn't appointed until later in April, I wanted to ask your response to the position that's being taken by DHS, which is, well, really is harmless. You know, the termination of rights didn't happen for quite some time, I think, until September of 2018, was it? September 21st, 2018. So why isn't it just harmless that the attorney wasn't appointed until April, when the attorney, there was an attorney, although the different attorney is apparently representing the mother all the way through until September of 2018?
Well, Your Honor, that's a large question to answer in one answer, but I'll break it down the best I can. As noted in petitioner's opening brief at page one, this was not in January the first time the Maui court ordered foster custody of mother's child. On October 7th, 2014, the family court judge in Maui ruled, while sitting on the bench of my client's FDS case for her child, L.I., and this is what the court said, I'll go ahead and award foster custody. I'll just say continued foster custody. And then he called upon my client to remember somehow the date the child was placed out of her home. And the judge just said, well, I'll say affect the date she was placed outside the home and we'll figure it out. Now, when my client made it clear in October that she had zero idea what was happening, did you say L.I. has ordered foster custody? What does that mean? And that's in the 10-7-14 transcript at page 14. The judge allowed DHS counsel, arguably opposing counsel, and in his own words, the bad guy, to explain what was happening to mom. He told her that as long as it's out of the home, it's classified as foster custody placement. So technically, this court deprived mother of custody on October 7th, 2014. However, as my brief made clear, for some reason, that order granting foster custody had the exes whited out and family supervision was entered. That happened all off record. So this court and I are both unable to figure out how on earth an on-record ruling of foster custody can be converted to an order that doesn't have it, but that's neither here nor there, because everyone agrees that the order filed from the January 15th hearing clearly awarded foster custody. So for Your Honor to go straight to the harmless error analysis misconstrues the Lohr test. State versus Lehrer made it very clear there's two ways structural error is going to be recognized. The first... Yes.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Mr. Glenn, I have another question for you from Justice Nakayama.
Well, I haven't finished answering Justice Wilson.
He was just getting around to answering.
I'm so sorry. Please go ahead.
It's okay. Sorry. I'll do whatever you guys tell me. I'm compliant.
Go ahead, Mr. Glenn.
Anyway, there are two ways to recognize structural error. The first is where certain rights protected by the Hawaii Constitution are so basic to a fair trial that their contravention can never be deemed harmless. And the second is where the impact of the error on conviction is impossible to reliably assess, and when harmless error review would require the appellate court to engage in pure speculation. Now, the family court's impermissible denial of mother's constitutional right to counsel in this child welfare case clearly satisfies either of those tests. As to the first method, note well that the state never argues that the right to counsel is not fundamental to a fair trial. Rather, they try to argue that the right wasn't contravened here. There's a word for the state's approach. It's bootstrapping. By definition, that right was contravened when she wasn't provided counsel upon the state assuming custody of her child. And trying to argue It wasn't contravened by delving into a harmless error analysis is attempting to bypass the Lohar test itself. Now, in both the briefings of the state and summary disposition order of the ICA, there's a noticeable void of relevant case law to support. I'm sorry, my camera fell. There's a noticeable void of relevant case law to support the proposition that Hawaii has decided to shun the structural error analysis in favor of harmless error in right to counsel cases. That's likely why I'm here today. Now, compare that void, however, to the abundance of relevant on-point case law cited by Mother and the amici in this appeal. In actuality, the only case cited by the ICA is an unpublished SDO, in its unpublished SDO, to support their choice of use harmless error analysis is INRI TM. There's no attempt to mention or even distinguish the long line of Hawaii cases and federal structural error cases made by the ICA.
Yes. If I could interrupt you, I think it would be Justice Nakayama, if we could allow her to pose her question, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Glenn, you are saying that the parent should have been afforded counsel upon DHS taking custody, but you are arguing that upon imposition of family suit that she should be having counsel at that point in time, aren't you?
I'm not arguing that. Amici is technically arguing that, but here's what we'd like your court to hold.
Well, wait a minute. If you're not arguing that, let me ask you this.
Yes.
What good is giving a mother counsel when DHS takes custody of the child? Shouldn't the mother have counsel so that the child is not taken from her?
Absolutely. As I was saying,
at what point would that be?
We would like this court to rule that prior to any court hearing in which foster custody is going to be discussed or raised, counsel must be appointed, and that failure to do so is structural error requiring reversal.
And so you would rewind back to what?
Any time there's going to be a hearing.
In this case,
I would say back on October 7th, the state was contemplating foster custody, that the court, well aware of the holding in TM.
In this case, what's going to happen in the future? What do you want to happen?
You mean if you remand this case?
Yes. At what point in time do we go back in the removal of the children and the imposition of foster custody?
Okay.
Do you want to go back to family supervision?
Well, here's the thing. It's not really up to me, Your Honor. It's up to the state of Hawaii. They run the show when it comes to children's custody and family suit and foster custody. So I take it if you vacate the termination of parental rights order, the state will decide whether they need to file another termination right, whether they're going to give her family suit, whether they're going to continue foster custody. And all of this will be done based on the current facts and based on current representation. And it's the same thing that happened in TM. Years went by since she lost her children, and this court had no problem or no difficulty vacating the terminating order and remanding it for future decisions. But that's really not up to me or my client.
You're not arguing that it goes back to when she was entitled to have counsel. You're saying you're going to leave it up to DHS as to what the next step is.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I don't know what the word it meant in your question when you said it is up to...
Well, I'm quoting what you said. When you said, I said, what's going to happen next? You said it depends on what DHS wants.
DHS will ask the state to do certain things, and Mother will agree or oppose. All of that is not really before this court, or really shouldn't even be considered.
That's why I'm asking you, what is your argument?
Pardon again?
Leaving it up to DHS, what do you think should happen?
Well, I think that... the family court should assess the current situation and do whatever's best in the children. When we're dealing with unknown facts and hypotheticals, I can't be more specific than that.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Glenn. At this point, your 11 minutes is up, so we'll move to Mr. Helper. Reserve your remaining time for rebuttal. Mr. Helper.
May it please the court. Thank you so much. We set my timer here. Thank you for considering our brief, and thank you for allowing us to argue today. I want to go directly to Justice Nakayama's question and propose January 9th, 2015 as the date that the court should rewind to. That's the date that the DHS filed the safe home, safe family home report that raised the issue for taking custody of the children. And that's consistent with our position, as Mr. Glenn said, that the basic issue here, our basic position, is that prior to any hearing in which custody may be an issue, counsel needs to be appointed prior to the hearing with sufficient time to prepare. In other words, prior to deprivation of custody, not upon deprivation of custody, which is the ambiguity I think we've identified in the TM case.
Very well. We have Justice McKenna has a question, Mr. Helper.
Thank you. Mr. Helper, I hear you arguing for January 9th, 2015. Right. I'm thinking about this. TM was based on the right to parental care, custody, and control of a child and the protection of that constitutional right. It appears that there was family supervision was actually taken in this case even before January of 2015, and actually care of the child was placed with other family members, at least for a while, right? Even though it wasn't foster custody, the state did not take custody at that point. So I'm wondering, do you really think that TM goes far enough in terms of protecting a parent's interest in the care, custody, and control of a child when family supervision can mean placement with other relatives, not with the parent themselves? And during that time, without counsel, findings can be made that are detrimental to the future care, custody, and control of the child. In other words, when a petition is filed under 587A-12, the parent is to be informed that parental rights may be terminated unless the family is willing and able, with the assistance of a service plan, to provide the child with a safe family home within a reasonable period of time. But it's that's the family, which includes extended family. The parent can still be losing care, custody, and control. And 587A17, the court-appointed attorneys provision, allows this court to establish guidelines on when attorney must be appointed to represent an indigent legal parent. And so why should this court not actually go even further back and say the constitutional rights of parents require appointment of counsel upon the filing of the petition?
A filing of petition for custody, Justice McKenna, or for family supervision?
The petition, 587A-12 petition, because at any time thereafter, there could be like an emergency hearing and the child could be taken from the parent. In the meantime, the parent needs to understand that if they don't comply, if it's family supervision under the parent needs to understand and needs to be advised by counsel that if they don't comply with each and every order, this is what's going to happen. They might lose the child.
Justice McKenna, I think that that's very much very consistent with the arguments we've raised in our brief, is that counsel should be appointed when family supervision begins, which in this case would have been, I think, June of 2014, as opposed to January of 2015 when the request for custody was filed.
Can you remind me when this petition was actually filed, the initial petition in court was actually filed?
So there was no petition. There was a family supervision was established in June of 2014. There never was a petition filed. There was only this safe family home report filed on January 9th, 2015, that led to the January 13th, 2015 hearing, at which the issue sort of came to a head and the mother lost custody.
So dialing the so certainly the clock needs to be reset at January 9th at the very latest. But I think there's also, as I think Justice McKenna suggests, a strong argument for dialing it back even further to June of 2014 when family supervision was established. And that's under the Doe case that says anytime there needs to be counsel, anytime there's a substantial impact, I believe, on the rights, on parental rights. And as Justice McKenna identified in her recitation of the statutes, once family supervision is established, DHS has a lot more power to take the kids without court approval. I think there was a question, perhaps.
Follow up for Justice Nakayama, or another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Helper, understanding that your argument is that there's a constitutional right for children, for parents to have counsel before their steps are taken to remove their children from their custody and control, how does this juxtapose with the statutory imperative that the court must look at the best interest of the child? So right now you're saying to rewind. At first you said January 9th, but perhaps maybe back to the time the petition was filed for family supervision. How is a trial court supposed to take into consideration the best interest of the child in evaluating how far back or to what extent the proceedings need to be rewound?
I think TM really addresses that. I mean, I don't think TM explicitly talks about how you balance parental rights versus the best interests of the child, but I don't think there's any particular conflict. I think the statutes generally recognize that the family reunification or keeping the family together is the sort of the default best interest of the child. There has to be something that happens to affect that, something significant before you can intrude on that presumption which protects both the best interests of the child and the parental constitutional right. But I don't think in this circumstance there's actually any conflict between the best interests of the child and providing the parent with counsel. I think that it helps the child that the parents have counsel.
Mr. Helper, your brief examines at some length of what other states have done and how many other states would say appointment of counsel should go all the way back to the petition for family supervision, and how many of them have done that by statute as opposed to a judicial determination that it's required under the Constitution?
If I recall our brief correctly, I think that addresses only the triggering of the right to counsel upon filing of some sort of a formal action to take custody as opposed to the sort of family supervision. So I'm not aware, I couldn't say for sure if any of those cases go farther back.
Very well, thank you.
Justice Wilson asked why this wasn't harmless, because she had counsel when the actual permanent deprivation of custody occurred, a couple of years later. I think the answer to that is found in a combination of TM and then the lower case. The lower case cites a number of other cases, Supreme Court and Hawaii, U.S. Supreme Court and others, but it basically says that counsel is required in a criminal case in every step of the proceeding. And that's, I think, a quote from the dissent in it is crucial that the defendant is provided with the guiding hand of counsel at every step of the proceedings, step in the proceedings against him. That's quoted in Lower with approval. And then when you move forward to TM says that it essentially imports those standards into the parental rights context, because it says, TM squarely says that deprivation of parental rights may in fact be more serious than a criminal charge. So I think once you take those two cases together, you pretty much get to the answer to the first prong of the lower test. which is this a fundamental right that the contravention can never be harmful error? So I think that that's, Justice Wilson, my response to your suggestion about possibly, you know, you can imply harmless error up until 2018 when she was permanently deprived. I think the second prong of the lower test also applies here, that again, as suggested in the TM decision, it's impossible to rewind and examine all the different decisions counsel may have made, whether counsel was appointed in 2014 or 2015, that there's, it lower itself concerned only one decision, the decision about whether the defendant should testify or not, or when the defendant should testify. And even that was found to be too speculative to be anything other than structural error when the defendant was denied the right to decide when he was going to testify. So there are so many other points in the years between, the months before she was provided with counsel that could have turned out differently had she been appointed counsel, and it's just too speculative.
The question from Justice Wilson.
CJ, Mr. Halper, I wanted to follow up on this proposition that you have proposed, that the nature of the relationship between the parent and appointed counsel would mean that there would be a significant contribution of counsel to this issue of parental rights. In other words, if one considers the attaching of the right to counsel at the time that the petition for family supervision is requested in June of 2014, then that would mean that counsel would have been available to the mother for that period of time up until this time when the temporary foster custody was granted, which took place in 2015. I guess that was in April. So I guess this is the point that you're making, that that would have been a period of time when theoretically, with the advice of counsel, perhaps it wouldn't have been necessary for the court to place in temporary foster care on April 14, 2015, L.I., right?
Well, Your Honor, you may be making an error in the chronology here. She lost custody on January 13th, not April. There was a hearing in April, but she lost custody at the January 13th.
Yes, thank you for clarifying that. That's right. She lost the temporary custody in January, and then in April she got counsel. Good point. Yeah, but my point is there's a significant period of time that the final decision as to whether or not, or the decision in January to put her in temporary foster care might have been different if counsel had been provided in the preceding time since June of 2014.
Yes. I mean, I think if you look at this record, and especially the confusion about what she did in November, December, and her deep confusion about what she was doing when she placed her kids with relatives, and then found out later, according, and this is related in the Safe Family Home report of January 9th, that she didn't understand when she put her kids with friends that she was surrendering legal custody in the opinion of DHS. So that's an argument for that's a point at which counsel clearly would have been of great assistance. But again, I think I know I'm well over my time here.
I think, Mr. Halper, you're well over your time. You're close to the 15 minutes. I will give you some time for rebuttal, however. But at this point,
thank you.
Let's head on to Mr. Menor for your argument.
Thank you so much.
Has to occur with considerations for what occurs in the real world, in the court calendars, and particularly those here in the Second Circuit. So this case starts off as a petition for family supervision. And it's the court's practice here that, you know, based on their considerations financially, and I'm not privy to that information, and their guidelines to qualify individuals, that they don't appoint counsel in family supervision cases. And it's not until there's the removal that the court then goes through the process of qualifying individuals under 587A17. And that's what it did in this case. And the record is clear that at the point when the court is attempting to get mother to qualify, and that these qualifications are court guidelines, they're not Department of Human Services guidelines, that she was less than cooperative in the process with regards to qualifying. So, you know, with all due respect, the court could have been more aggressive in its setting of the return with hearing counsel hearing. And, but, you know, in this case, what happened was the department made an assessment that mother could no longer provide a safe family home with the assistance of a service plan, and it needed to immediately remove the child from what it assessed as an unsafe situation. Everyone learned about that at that periodic review.
We have a question from Justice.
At the periodic review hearing on the 13th.
Thank you, Mr. Menor. So it seems to me that based on what you're saying, from the beginning, it was going to be family supervision, perhaps outside from the mother's care. Is my understanding correct? And also, so initially it was supposed to be the mother that continued, but then at some point, several months later, the child was placed with relatives for at least a month or two. But my real question is, you're talking about the Second Circuit. Is there a difference between circuits on how these cases are handled? Are you aware of whether other circuits appoint counsel at an earlier time?
I'm not aware. I can only speak to my experience in the Second Circuit. And to the earlier part of your question, is family supervision is understood that the child will reside with a custodial parent. And when a parent decides to delegate care, if you will, to someone who is not the custodial parent, then the department needs to be able to make an assessment on whether that is safe. So family supervision is understood that the child will reside with a safe custodial parent.
Why was the child removed at least for like a month or two in late 2014?
So an issue arose on where exactly the child was living for a majority of the time, who the child was living with, and whether or not mother was actually caring for the child under family supervision. So that was one of the issues. But clearly, by the time January 2015,
why was the child removed at that time?
In 2014?
Yes, in October of 2014.
Yeah, this is all about, can the department verify where the child is and who the child is living with?
And so why wouldn't mother be entitled to counsel at that point before the child was actually removed?
In 2014?
Yes.
So, you know, it's the department's position that counsel should be appointed in family supervision, foster custody, temporary foster custody cases. But it's the practice of the court to not appoint in the family supervision cases until the child actually faces the threat of removal. And you know, I can't speak as to why that is, other than that is the practice.
Question. Can I ask one practical question? In yes. Your experience overseeing these cases in the Second Circuit, what percentage of these FCS cases start off with family supervision and then result in eventual foster custody being taken by the state?
I don't know if I can answer. I can say that the number of family supervision filings is comparatively small, compared to, say, temporary foster custody. But I wouldn't know. I'd be speculating on what percentage of then those family supervision cases result in removal. I wouldn't be able to answer that.
So what I hear you saying is there's actually not that many cases that are filed initially as family supervision that then go on to perhaps other more restrictive measures.
I'm only going to say that comparatively, the initial filing for family supervision to the other types of petitions is comparatively small.
Thank you very much.
Smaller.
Thank you. We have a question from Justice Wilson. Justice Wilson.
Thank you. Mr. Minor, what are your thoughts about the concept that the failure to provide counsel would be analogous to the failure to provide counsel in the criminal context, as in the lower case, and therefore that would be a structural error that I presumably would require that the decision of the court to terminate parental rights would necessarily be reversed?
So I think the court should be very, very cautious in assigning the new standard as structural error, because there's just very distinct differences between criminal cases and those in family court. You know, in a criminal case, you've got a crime that's occurred, and it's those facts are generally established when you have an investigation, perhaps an indictment or a charging document. And then the lawyer comes on and is engaging in discovery. And, you know, at that point, and then it proceeds to trial or some other disposition. But in a family court case, it's the family court judge is given a kind of an additional or almost a unique discretion to be involved in the case and to assist the parties in what is, under the statute, a potential ultimate goal of reunification. So the courts are, the type of cases are very different. On top of that, in a CPS case, the judge always has to consider the best interests of the child. And that's simply not something that needs to be done in a criminal case. And so the environment.
Let me follow up on that. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you raise an interesting point. So if I understand you, you're saying that it might not necessarily be in the best interest of the child if a determination made by the court to terminate parental rights or to even grant a temporary foster custody would be reversed, because in that situation may not be in the best interest of the child, because you have a fact situation that would clearly indicate that the child should not be with the parent. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, can I apply it then to the facts of this case? What you have is you have a determination of removal made in 2015 as the basis to overturn or to, you know, not consider the 41 months in which mother had counsel and had the assistance of counsel. I think if you focus on procedurally, what protections did she have during the point once she was appointed counsel, I think that could then answer your question, Justice Wilson. Her rights to contest and contest the permanency and the termination, we're all with the assistance of counsel. And so kind of going back to this period of 97 days early in the case as the basis for completely undoing that would ignore the procedural history of the case.
But with the assistance of counsel, you know, again, it's very hard to go back and sort of hypothesize about what might have happened. And that's kind of the point of calling a structural error in this case. Would there not have been things that counsel could have done prior to that January 15 hearing that would have put her in a better posture to argue against family supervision, for example, before then the children are taken and put in foster custody? And then that becomes sort of a basic fact of the case.
So, see, the case starts off as family supervision. And when in January 2015, there's this sense to remove the child, what the court did was at that point was to set a return hearing so that mother could qualify and a counsel could be brought on board. And the court then even allowed mother to preserve the right to challenge the removal, to challenge any change in placement, and to challenge what would at that point was a new proposed service plan given the removal. So I'm focusing on that point in time because of the practice to point primarily once in removal cases in this court, this judicial circuit.
Very well. Please continue.
Okay, so, you know, under the current scheme, I think there's a qualification requirement imposed by statute. And that's what the court did here. At the point it removed the child, it then set a return hearing to see if she could then qualify for counsel. And it's the record's clear that there were issues with her ability to cooperate with.
Mr. Glenn, if you would, please, don't gesture or shake your head during opposing counsel's argument. Thank you.
So even if, for discussion's sake, even if in that January 2015 hearing, counsel was already in court next to mother, that day was what we call a non-evidentiary review hearing calendar. There's a lot of cases on that typical calendar. And what would have happened was the case would have been set for a contested setting on a different day to litigate, both sides can bring witnesses, et cetera. And the only difference here is that counsel needed to be appointed prior to that occurring. So that was what the family court did, and that was what the family court intended when it said, okay, you can challenge these in the subsequent setting in, I believe it was May of 2015 when counsel finally gets on board. In terms of, the structural error, it would have been structural error if once counsel is on board for the court to completely deny any type of hearing or ability for mother to challenge its removal, its placement, the service plan. But it didn't do that. It preserved her ability to challenge. And on top of that, it also had, if it had been litigated, that would have been an appealable order that could have been appealed to the appellate level. But what happens in August, mother stipulates. She stipulates to foster custody of L.I., the service plan, and to the placement. So she has stipulated at that point with the advice of counsel. And then from that point forward, she has counsel continuously through the remainder of the review period where she was provided multiple service plans to address issues in her life. And then when it appeared that the case was moving towards permanency, she had counsel for those proceedings as well, all the way until the very end. So, it's one thing to kind of point to this period at the adjudication stage to say that that's the basis to undo what happens post. And this court needs to understand that there are different standards.
Mr. Minor, we have a question from Justice Wilson. Unmute. No, we need to. Sorry, Justice Wilson. I think you weren't muted. You were still muted there. So.
Okay. Well, that gives me a chance to maybe ask the question more clearly. But I appreciate the sort of, if you will, survey of the record to see the extent to which counsel actually would have made a difference. But it strikes me that that kind of work by our court to survey the record and see the extent to which counsel really made a difference is a reason why, in law, the structural nature of the error was recognized. Because, for example, while you make the point that there was a long period of time before there was a final decision to terminate, in the period prior to January, when the child was placed in temporary foster care, there was a family plan in place, and there were problems happening. Like, for example, missing urinalysis tests was a problem. And right around that time, not too much after April when counsel was appointed, but the drug problem was so great that, as you recall, the second child, HDK, was born with apparently with exposure to the drugs that the mother had been taking. So what's my point? During this four-month period even, or if you go back to October, it makes the point even longer, but this was a dynamic point in the relationship between the court, the mother, and the child, because obviously there was already a family supervision that had been asserted. There was a plan in place. Drugs were being taken. So here we go in trying to determine whether maybe if there had been an attorney during that 4 months, things wouldn't have been quite as bad and the child wouldn't have been put into temporary foster care. So I just wanted to ask your thoughts about that, because that was a pretty pregnant moment, that 4 month period when between January of 2015 and April of 2015. How do we know that it wasn't significant just because it took so much longer a couple of years later before the parental rights were permanently terminated?
Well, I'm only going to answer that the case maintained in family supervision from that point on until January of 2015. And it's, you know, I hate to fall back on a policy, but it's the Second Circuit's policy that in family supervision, counsel's not appointed. And to kind of try to answer your question, I think that's the speculative nature in the second prong of lower. We can look to what actually happened or what was actually provided to mother in the way of representation once she got counsel. And again, there was that ability to challenge in the middle part of 2015 that mother could challenge the removal with counsel and sit it for trial.
Mr. Minor, we have a question from Judge Cataldo. Judge Cataldo.
Mr. Minor, I may have misunderstood. I understand that you're saying it's the policy of the Second Circuit not to appoint counsel with a petition for family supervision, but did I understand you to say that it's the position of DHS to do so?
Oh, no, it's the judiciary. That's their policy.
Let me just be clear. It is not a position that DHS takes anywhere that counsel should be appointed if a petition for family supervision is filed.
Oh, the department position has always been counsel should be appointed, whether it be family supervision, foster custody, or voluntarily or temporary foster custody.
And why is that?
It's the presence of counsel helps assist in the process. I will agree with that completely, for no other reason than that.
If that's the position of DHS, how do I reconcile the position that there is no structural error if an attorney is not appointed at that very beginning of the matter?
Well, you know, again, trying to graft structural error onto a Child Protective Act case, which has all of its own unique characteristics, you'd have to essentially say that in this case specifically, that the process was so flawed and just the procedural history of 41 months with counsel, you know, I would ask this court to continue to apply harmless error standard.
Do you see any value in a bright line test?
The bright line in the appointment of counsel? That's the current law under TM.
Well, a bright line test in the appointment of counsel, say, for example, at the time a petition for family supervision is filed, and a bright line test that indicates there is no harmless error if that is done. In other words, there is structural error if that is not done.
I would disagree with that. To the first part of your question is, can counsel be appointed? That's subject to 587A17 and the guidelines imposed by the court. So that's something that the court needs to determine and engage in the process to develop, okay, what exactly is going to happen under 587A17 so that an indigent party can get counsel. But in this case here, the facts of this case don't warrant structural error analysis, and that this court should continue to use harmless error analysis given the procedural history of the case once counsel was appointed for mother.
Thank you.
So essentially, if you look at, you know, what the point where the petitioner is asking that, you know, structural error occur, throughout the life of the case, the standards are different. And so by the time we get to permanency and the permanent deprivation of parental rights, the standard has increased, the burden has increased, and the information that the court uses is definitely much more. So I think, there's a difference between adjudicating harm and the termination of parental rights under Hawaii Revised Statutes 587A33. And that's has to be part of the calculus in determining whether structural error or harmless error is used in the analysis. And again, the summary disposition order by the lower court essentially said it failed to identify any prejudice to mother as a result of the proceedings that took place. Now, one of the things is, okay, so what happens if, you know, what is a remedy that can be instituted? And essentially what's happening is the petitioner is asking to vacate a termination order based on a removal order almost 41 months prior, again, with the different standards, different information for the court, and the different level of facts by the time this case comes before the court for a termination. Mother was represented during all the compliance periods and review periods once she got counsel. She was represented at the termination hearings once those were scheduled. And she was fully able to assert her positions at those subsequent trials, bring all the witnesses that she needed to do, that she wanted to present, and she was able to do that. So I think one of the other things here is the second child.
Justice Wilson has a question. Justice Wilson, you're still muted. Oh, there you go.
Thank you. It keeps occurring to me that when you say that in the criminal context, if counsel is either removed or counsel for some reason, because of court action, isn't permitted to be part of court proceedings, the court doesn't, the appellate court doesn't then engage in an analysis about how important that deprivation of counsel might have been, because it's so difficult to really know, given the nature of the relationship between the attorney and the client, and also the difficulty in trying to measure the importance of one part of the criminal proceeding compared to another part of the criminal proceedings. So I'm not following you really when you say, let's evaluate those areas in which there was an absence of counsel and see if it really made a difference compared to those circumstances where counsel was available during the time that the court was considering parental rights.
So, and I hope this answers your question, Justice, but You know, the fairness of the proceedings is why counsel is appointed. And in all the proceedings, once counsel was appointed by the court, counsel was there to assist mother completely. And even at the point where there's the absence of counsel, the court ensured, you know, by setting that return with counsel and setting the potential to contest the removal and the placement and the service plan, the court preserved that ability to do so, and with counsel, effectively stipulated to those.
Justice McKenna has a question for you, Mr. Menor.
Mr. Menor, I want to make sure I understand your position here. It appears to me that you are saying that from the DHS's perspective, from the state's perspective, you believe that counsel should be appointed from the very beginning. And apparently that is consistent with 32 of 43 states that recognize the right to counsel and the ABA standards, as well as the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, all recommend that counsel be appointed right from the very beginning, from whenever a petition is filed, or at least by the time before an actual hearing, any hearing takes place. So I hear you saying that you tend to agree with that position. However, you think that with respect to this case, you don't think that the decision should be set aside. Is my understanding correct?
My position is, regardless of the relief sought in the petition, that counsel should be appointed. It's the position that at a return hearing, once a party can qualify under 587A17, that's realistically in the real world, that's when counsel's appointed. So I'm not suggesting at the filing, I'm suggesting at a point where there's a return hearing and qualifications have been determined by the court based on their guidelines, and a counsel is actually appointed by the court.
All right.
Does that answer your question?
Yes. And you've also indicated that you do not know what the practice of other circuits is as to when counsel is appointed, correct?
Correct. I can only
Is that something that you're an attorney general? Is that something you can ascertain if you were asked?
I mean, my office would be able to get the information, but for me, I exclusively practice in the Second Circuit.
Thank you.
So, you know, in closing, DHS recognizes the importance of counsel in Child Protective Act cases. You know, the timing of TM needs to be clarified, but it can do so without vacating the termination order in this case. There was no prejudice on the record to overturn or vacate the termination of parental rights order, and that this court should continue to use the harmless error standard, and particularly in looking at this case. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Menor. Mr. Glenn, your rebuttal. I'll just advise you, Mr. Glenn, your signal on your internet's been in and out a bit, so if we're not able to hear you, I'll let you know, and then we'll be able to solve that by just having you go turn off your video and go audio only. But let's try and see. Let's give it a try and see how it works. All right.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor. To touch on a few points made by counsel, and also one of the questions asked by Justice, as far as my reading of 587A17, it says nothing about when. When Your Honor was asked, indicating that the court may appoint an attorney to represent a legal parent who is indigent based on court-appointed guidelines, I would posit that the court-appointed guidelines are only qualifying the indigency, which is why that statute discusses so much about recoupment. If they appointed a counsel to someone who could afford to pay for it, they're going to get their money back. So when counsel mentioned practice or policy of the court without citing to any written policy or any written guideline or any written statement about what a practice is, I refer the court to the statute itself that says at any time the court may appoint an attorney to represent a parent who's indigent. In fact, Your Honor, Your Honors, I posit that with the ease with which the child was appointed a guardian in this matter, which was instantaneously and without application, can similarly be done with counsel in all matters. Now, there will probably be a time when a family supervision case over a mother or father occurs, where obviously this parent needs counsel. Either they're incompetent or unruly or unstable, but either way, there is nothing preventing the court currently to this day from appointing an attorney to any indigent parent in any child protective act.
Okay, Mr. Glenn, we're losing you a bit here. Perhaps if you turn your video off, we'll be able to hear you. Let's see if we can hear you. Can you hear me, Mr. Glenn?
Thank you. I sure can.
So sorry. All right. If that's okay, shall we proceed like this?
Yes, please. I don't mind.
Thank you. Here, go ahead. Oh, again, I'm sorry, Mr. Glenn, you're breaking up. You're still breaking up. So we may have to. Oh, Mr. Glenn, we're not able to hear you. I'm sorry. Should we take a recess?
I am able to hear you.
Okay, let's try again, Mr. Glenn. I won't hold that time against you. Let's give it a try, and then otherwise we may have to take a brief recess and try to get you back online. So let's give it a shot again, Mr. Glenn. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor. Regarding the distinct differences mentioned by counsel between criminal and family court, I agree. There are distinct differences. One of them is in a criminal case, a defendant cannot be compelled to testify or even need to present a defense. However, in family court special cases, parents are asked by judges direct and pointed questions, and they need counsel to assist them to prepare for that. So that is a distinct difference that does not go in counsel's favor. As to Judge Cataldo's question about the bright line test, the ICA has already made this clear. The delay in this case was impermissible. What does impermissible means if it's going to be permitted? I'll now conclude unless there's questions from any justice.
I'm not seeing any, so thank you, Mr. Glenn.
I'll enter my conclusion. I didn't mean I would finish.
I'll bring it up at this point.
I'll enter my concluding statement, Your Honor.
Please.
Mother asked Your Honors to require our state to make good on the promises made in TM some 6 years ago. Can Mother not rely on the words must appoint counsel for indigent parents, which this court directed and ordered in TM? What does the word guarantee mean when used by this court in TM? Is the guarantee something that is actionable or is it meaningless? The guarantee was not meaningless to the mother of TM, so it should not be meaningless to my client. The arguments made by counsel were made and agreed to by the ICA in TM. They said there were no challenge findings that would point to a different result, and there's no indication that it would have been prejudiced to rights. But this court rejected those arguments when it overruled the ICA's opinion. Your Honors can help make our Aloha State a better state for its citizens by making it clear in your decision that because counsel was to be appointed to Mother, because she was literally guaranteed the right to counsel in this matter, and that the failure to do so is impermissible, that because of this guarantee, the family court of the Second Circuit's failure to do what it was required to do on two occasions, mind you, is structural error demanding reversal. Mother heard this court explain that parental rights guaranteed under the Hawaii Constitution would mean little if parents were deprived the custody of their children without a fair hearing. That is precisely what happened in the instant case. The court should remedy this constitutional violation by holding that prior to any court hearing in which foster custody is going to be discussed or raised, counsel appointed, and that the failure to do so is structural error requiring reversal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Glenn. Mr. Helper, your rebuttal.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. Just jumping around on a couple of points. First of all, Justice McKenna helpfully answered, I think, Justice Rexwald's question about the practice in other states. And that's, I believe, a reference to our brief about the 32 of 43 states appointing counsel at the very first hearing. So I misspoke earlier when I said that our brief didn't address it, because it does. Second, many of the Attorney General's arguments about waiver, about the procedure, were identical to arguments that were raised in TM. If the court looks at footnote 16, there's a recitation of the arguments made by DHS on that argument, very similar to what we've heard today. And the court didn't actually even explicitly address those arguments in TM, but it did certainly reject them. I'm a little confused about the state's position on when the right attaches or when it should attach, but I think there's certainly a recognition that an attorney is very helpful to have at the very earliest stage of proceedings here when family supervision is imposed. And so I think given that, the importance of a bright line rule just saying counsel needs to be appointed at the first hearing would be invaluable for everyone involved in the process. My last point is that I think the state is really misconstruing the lower test. Under lower, there's two prongs, the fundamental right prong and the sort of reconstructing or trying to predict the future prong. If either of those prongs is met, then it's structural error. And you can't then look at what happened after the error to figure out and speculate about what would happen. That's the whole point of the test.
Could I ask you a question? What if counsel was appointed a week after, like before the end of January? Would your analysis be the same?
It would be, Your Honor. I think that any delay would be an error here. I think that the statutes contemplate a hearing within a couple of days, but it's the act of having a hearing at all that is the violation, not necessarily the delay. That the hearing went forward without counsel and potential prejudice to the parents in that case. So it's not the length of the delay, it's the fact of the hearing, I think, that is the error.
Anything further for the court at this point, Mr. Helper?
I think that's it, Your Honor. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you to all of our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Ua ho'o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolokolo ki'e ki'e hanohano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.